Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey everyone, it's Mary from Only Human, and this is a special extra conversation we wanted to share with you guys. This week, my producer Jillian and I went to North Carolina to a gender clinic at Duke University. The doctors there mostly see transgender kids. When I got back, I had so many questions about what was going on down there. Mostly how the rules about gender seem to have changed so quickly. And I wondered what life would be like for a kid who identifies as trans now if they were in some other time or place. So I got in touch with Alice Dreger.
The frustration I had in trying to find clothing for my son that was not dark blue or dark green or black.
Or had a football on it.
With a football on it.
Alice is a medical historian who studies how we think about sex and gender. She says she understands how conflicted we are about this stuff, both because she's a historian and because she's a mom. Her son's a teenager now, but when he was a baby...
You know, I went to Old Navy and I wanted to buy him onesies that were brightly colored, orange and yellow. And you could not buy a brightly colored onesie without a bow on it. And and the bow was on it in such a way that when I tried to take the bow off, I ruined the onesie. And why did I try to take the bow off? Because I didn't want people thinking my son was a girl, because I have the same damn problems everybody else does, right?
Alice is a really straight talker. And full disclosure, some of her opinions are pretty controversial. But she really understands how our definition of gender is evolving and why. I wanted to talk to you because we spent a day at this clinic in North Carolina where they deal with kids who are transitioning from one gender to another or kids who are questioning their gender. And we came out the other end with a lot of questions, basically. So I'm just curious, like, when was the first time you heard of a teenager transitioning from one gender to another using hormones?
Well, I don't know the first time I heard of it, but I know of people who did that in the 1970s, for example, at the Stanford Clinic, clinics that were working with adults at the time, and they were starting to get late teenagers that they were working with, and they started transitioning those over in terms of sex hormones.
When did it become more common practice?
We're not really sure, because one of the shifts that occurred was that things started to shift from being done in the adult clinics to being done in the pediatric clinics. When it started to become really big in the United States was about 15 years ago, and then especially about 10 years ago. In the last 5 years, it's just exploded in terms of now every major children's hospital has a gender clinic.
Why do you think that is?
Well, part of what's happened is social media has made it possible for people to understand transgender in a more realistic and more positive way. So part of what's going on is people have less phobia around it, and that causes people to be more aware of the possibility. That said, I think also part of what's gone on is an assumption that's overly simplistic that thinks that everybody sorts neatly into straight and gay, into male and female, into transgender or not transgender. And so there's an assumption that when a child expresses a feeling that they are not the gender you think they are, that that must mean that they're transgender.
What did treatment for kids like this used to look like?
Well, so that's a tricky question, because when you say kids like this, we're not sure if the population that used to show up in the clinics is the same as the population today. And what we do know is that kids who appeared to be gender atypical, or what today we would call gender nonconforming, meaning they didn't fit the standard assumptions about how girls should behave or boys should behave, those kids sometimes ended up in gender clinics in the 1970s. But those were kids often who probably didn't have any kind of gender dysphoria, probably didn't think that they were meant to have been born in a different body. What they probably were just kids who were going to grow up to be gay or lesbian. So is the population we see today even the same population? Probably not, but there's probably some degree of overlap. And one of the concerns that folks have, and I share that concern, is the assumption that all the kids who show up in gender clinics today are meant to be transgender. That is to say that they really are transgender. And in fact, the population is a heterogeneous population. It's a diverse population that probably includes kids who might otherwise grow up to be gay or lesbian, might grow up to be transgender, but might not grow up to be transgender. It really just all depends on the children. it's not the case that people have a set internal essence that will necessarily come out no matter what culture does to them. Culture gives us clues. And so depending on the cultural clues we're given, some of us will end up seeing ourselves differently than we would in other cultures.
How do other cultures address gender differently?
We could talk about 100 different cultures, but I'll give you one example. So in Samoa, there are sometimes boys born who are kind of, when they get to be toddlers and a little bit older, they tend to be kind of femme, and they prefer doing the tasks that are normally assigned to girls and women. They prefer playing with girls. They prefer wearing girls' clothing. They see themselves as being much more girlish in the standards of the culture than being boyish. And they are recategorized as this third gender category called fafafine, which means living in the matter of a woman. And what happens for them is they're raised as girls and they grow up to be what we would call transgender women. Part of the reason that happens in Samoa is the recognition that boys like that are going to grow up and be attracted to other men. And it's disruptive in the Samoan culture to have someone who would be homosexual. And so this prevents somebody growing up to be homosexual by basically normalizing them into a system that says, if you're going to grow up to be attracted to men, then it makes sense that you're a woman. What that tells us is that gender variation and sexual orientation variation appears to naturally vary in the human population, and it varies regardless of culture. So nature provides biological variation. And then the question is, what do you do with that biological variation? And what ends up happening in different cultures is different ways of categorizing those variations in order to make sense of them.
But what you're saying is really that this is a choice, and that gets sticky, right?
Well, choice is a funny word, right? It's not exactly a choice. Our culture constrains the ways that we see ourselves and the ways that we see other people. So calling it a choice, I think, assumes too much agency on the part of the individual. In fact, what happens is the culture decides what options are available to us. So, for example, I mean, a good example is when we're born in this country, there are only two options on the birth certificate, male and female. And so the way that our parents will see us will be constrained in terms of those options. What's happening right now is something that in general is really positive, which is an expansion in terms of the options of how we can see each other. I do think that all other things being equal, it's a lot easier on your body if you don't cross over your sex hormones and you don't have top or bottom surgery. Parents desperately want certainty out of their children's doctors. I say that as a parent myself, that what you want for your child more than anything in the world is certainty, because you want to know, what are they going to grow up to be? Are they going to be okay? Who's going to love them? So when your child is in a liminal state, they seem to be sick, but you're not sure what the diagnosis is, or in circumstances where their identity is in flux. But when these parents go to these clinicians and they're looking for certainty, they're doing it because they love their children desperately. And they want really badly to resolve and to fix it and to make it all okay.
Can you talk to me a little bit about the incentive structure here? You know, you mentioned how parents are operating in this world and patients are operating in a world where there are certain options that are available and certain options that aren't. Talk to me a little bit about how payment gets roped into these decisions.
In medical care, a lot of the decisions that medical care providers will make depends on what can be reimbursed for the patient, because doctors and nurses and social workers don't want to put a patient and a family in the position of having to have care recommended to them that is not accessible to them in terms of affordability. And so one of the facts is that at a lot of the gender clinics, the kinds of services that many insurance companies will reimburse include endocrinological services, that means hormones, and will also sometimes include surgical services for older kids. It will not include very much psychological care, and it won't include social work. And it also will not include access to peer support. And so the result of that is, if you figure out what you're going to recommend to a patient based on being sensitive to affordability, what you're going to recommend is what insurance will reimburse. And that's going to lean towards the direction of reimbursing interventions that are more invasive than psychological and social work interventions. It's because things like hormones and things like genitals are taken as more real than the mind and relationships are. And that's extremely unfortunate. And it means a lot of people don't get the care that they really need.
And of course, you know, this clinic was in North Carolina, where all the HB2 stuff is happening. I guess I wonder, more broadly, for all of us, what is it about gender that makes it so hard for this expansion to be taking place?
Well, it looks hard, but as a historian, I have to tell you, we're going forward. It's getting better. And the reason I say that is 100 years ago, it would have been inconceivable that I, as a woman, could have a PhD and wear pants and earn the money I earn. And it would have been inconceivable, absolutely inconceivable, that the law would acknowledge that I could marry a woman. So we are moving forward. The law now acknowledges transgender people to the extent that every state does have ways to allow people to change their gender legally. So we are moving forward. What we see in North Carolina is a hateful backlash because people like their categories neat, and the reality is people don't come in simple categories. So whenever people with privilege see somebody entering into a privilege zone, then they get upset. The way you have privilege is to keep some people out. That's what it means to have privilege, is to have a zone where other people are not allowed in. Bathrooms, historically speaking, I know it sounds weird, but they've been places of privilege. And I know this sounds
weird. Tell me
weird.
More about that. Yeah.
It sounds weird, but this has been particularly true for women. Women's bathrooms have been sanctuaries for women. They have been places where labor movement organizations have occurred. So in women's factories, it was typically men who were the managers. And women's bathrooms were a place that women used to do labor agitation, where they could talk to each other and organize in terms of the union. Women have also used it as a place of respite, where we have either had or claimed to have our periods in order to go rest before the days when drugs were easily available. That's why you still see in many women's bathrooms a bench or a couch that you don't see in men's bathrooms, because that dates back to the old menstruation times when you were allowed to have a respite. And so women's bathrooms have been places of privilege for women. And so women sometimes react to the idea of transgender people coming into the bathroom because they see that as a violation of women's privilege. But men also worry about it because they see women as being sort of the property that they're supposed to protect and own. And the idea that another man might have access to a place where their women are freaks men out. Now, they don't understand this isn't a man, this is a person who's a transgender woman, but that is part of the visceral level at which they're reacting. So this is one of the birth pangs along the way of getting to a place where people calm down more about gender.
You know, you've become this kind of controversial figure in the trans community. Why?
I was joking to somebody today that I'm supposedly a notorious transphobe who keeps working for transgender rights. So a couple of reasons. One is that I do talk about the fact that young children are not magically either transgender or not, that in fact many of them could go either way. And that's not the standard story that a lot of adults with transgender want to tell. Although a lot of adults who are transgender do say that they agree that some of these kids will not grow up to be transgender. So it's not unified in that population.
He has like an area where the rules are being totally rewritten. So we're just feeling our way, like mom, dad, kids, doctor, everyone. Even if there are rules, it felt like that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the tendencies in America is to assume that everybody has a sort of core authentic identity. And we've totally lost track of the fact that our identities are relational. The way I know I'm a woman is because there are other women or there are men. The way I know I'm a mother is because I have a son. The way I know I'm a wife is that I have a spouse. The way that I know I'm white is that we have categories of people who look like me versus people who don't look like me. And so the way we know who we are is not because magically inside some voice chirps up, this is who I am. It says, this is who I am in relationship to other people. And so I think we're really losing that and assuming that everybody has a sort of magical core authentic identity. and forgetting the fact that we figure out who we are based on how we relate to other people. And that's what the best clinics are trying to do, is helping children and young people and then adults figure out who they are in relation to other people and trying to figure out what's the best way for you to be in the world. And for some people, the answers may be different. For some people, living a queer life with a cisgendered body may work. For some people, being transgender may work. For some people, living sometimes as one gender and sometimes as another gender works for them. So it's not the case that everybody is either magically male or magically female, and we just use gender clinics to divine who is who. In fact, we're all kind of figuring out who we are.
That was Alice Dreger. She's a medical historian and the author of Galileo's Middle Finger. We'd love to hear what you have to say about this conversation. So leave us a comment at onlyhuman.org, or you can even give us a call at 803-820-WNYC. Thanks.